Hello, and welcome to the reading of the Cedar Rapids Gazette for today. It's Thursday, January 18. I'm your reader, Kathleen. From the front page of the Gazette today, a photo at the Cedar Rapids Airport, travelers dig out snowbound cars. This story is by Aaron Jordan. Armed with just an ice scraper and warm memories of their trip to Hawaii, Josh Figg and Brian Duffy had to dig their SUV out of 3 feet of snow Saturday at the Eastern Iowa Airport. "I actually have a car shovel, but it's sitting in our garage," said Figg, age 39, of North Liberty. While Figg and Duffy were in Kauai and Oahu, two winter storms left their car and others in the airport parking lot buried under drifts or blocked in by plowed snow. Adding insult to injury, the temperature, when they flew in Saturday afternoon, was in the single digits. Duffy had packed his winter coat in the car, but Figg was in just a sweatshirt and vest with a bandana tied around his head as they used a long-handled ice scraper with a brush to clear snow from behind the tires. They took turns sitting in the idling car when their hands and feet got too cold. When Duffy spotted an airport plow driving nearby, he flagged down the driver. "They were wonderful," Figg said of the plow drivers. "It looked like they were out there to help people dig out." The plow driver helped clear snow from behind the couple's SUV before going to help another driver whose car battery had died. "Iowa Nice was definitely on display," Figg said. Figg's company often offers incentive trips in early January. They've come home to find bad weather before, including a storm that left their car coated in ice. That time, they rented another car to drive home and then came back the next day to scrape. "We've come home to a lot of gnarly stuff before, but this was definitely a first, coming home to this much snow," he said. Adam Smith of Cedar Rapids wanted to relieve his relatives of this burden and cleared the snow from on and around their parked car Monday before their flight was expected to arrive around midnight. Airport spokesperson Pam Hinman said the airport has shovels at the guest services desk across from baggage claim, and guest services staff may be able to assist, although their primary responsibilities are assisting people with wheelchairs and valet customers. "In really tough situations, our maintenance folks also assist, but they are also busy clearing runways, taxiways, sidewalks, parking lots, and so on," Hinman said. For future travel, guests may want to consider the full-service valet option, which requires a reservation and costs $20 per day. Figg said he wishes the Eastern Iowa Airport would build a covered parking ramp like the Des Moines International Airport. Covered parking in Des Moines starts at $20 a day, compared to the $11 per day in Cedar Rapids long-term parking. And again, that article is accompanied by two photos of Josh and Bryant as they try to dig out after the storm. Also on the front page today, this story by Grace King. Teachers could earn up to $16,500 more in first year. Iowa schools could offer beginning teachers a salary increase of up to $16,500 under a bill proposed by Governor Kim Reynolds, in a program estimated to cost $96 million in its first year. The burgeoning salary could make a difference in attracting people to the profession, as a nationwide teacher shortage continues to impact school districts across Iowa. "Anything we can do to distinguish ourselves and give ourselves a competitive edge is a game changer. It gives us the ability to be more competitive nationally," said Darius Ballard, Chief Human Resource Officer for the Cedar Rapids Community School District. The proposal, filed last week as House Study Bill 542, would set the salary for first-year teachers at $50,000 a year and set a $62,000 annual salary for teachers with 12 or more years of experience. Currently, the minimum teacher pay in Iowa is $33,500, set by lawmakers more than a decade ago. The average salary for teachers in the Cedar Rapids Community School District, the second largest in the state, is about $66,800. First-year teachers in the district make an average of $47,410, Ballard said. Teachers with 12 years of experience and a bachelor's degree earn about $54,160, according to the Cedar Rapids School District salary schedule. This does not include educators who have continuing education credits or advanced degrees. The bill also proposes controversial changes to Iowa's area education agencies that provide expertise to educators and families. It would prohibit AEAs from offering services beyond special education for students, and school districts could drop their current agency and look elsewhere for the services. On the chopping block under the governor's proposal would be media and technology and educational services, including math, science, and literacy, expertise offered to school districts by the 9 AEAs across the state. Melissa Peterson, a lobbyist for the Iowa State Education Association, said it's a distraction to add teacher pay to a bill that created so much immediate controversy. We're encouraging legislators to split these issues, Peterson said. We would like to see the AEA conversion separated from the compensation question. Both are very important and very complicated. The bill also does not address pay for education support professionals such as paraprofessionals, bus drivers, and food service workers, educated said. Mount Vernon Schools Superintendent Greg Battenhorst said if the bill passes as is, changes made to area education agencies would be crushing. While you may potentially give teachers more money, are you taking away things that are going to impact the climate and culture of the classroom so significantly that the increased pay is not truly worth it? Battenhorst said. Battenhorst said he does support increasing teacher pay wholeheartedly, but he questions how sustainable the proposal is financially. It also could put pressure on districts to rebuild their salary schedules, a series of steps and ranges that determine pay rates over time. For example, first-year teachers could earn the same salary as teachers with 11 years of experience if the bill were to pass. Lisa Breitfelder, superintendent of two rural school districts, North Lynn and Central City, said the proposal would increase the salary of first-year teachers in her district by $12,000. Is it needed? Absolutely, Breitfelder said. However, as the leader of school districts with a combined student body of about 1,000, she's concerned about the loss of area education services if the bill were to pass as is. Grant Wood AEA, the agency that serves 7 counties in eastern Iowa, provides North Lynn and Central City with curriculum consultants, technology expertise, science curriculum, and professional development. People are being steered away from careers as teachers in Iowa because of the negative spotlight on their career, not because of salary, Breitfelder said. To fund the salary increases, the bill proposes the Iowa Department of Management create up to 10 tiers to group school districts based on enrollment, said Margaret Buckton, a lobbyist for the Urban Education Network and Rural Schools Advocates of Iowa. The Department of Management would then determine how much money it would take to reach the minimum salary requirements for each tier, and the money would be distributed by the Teacher Salary Supplement, a per-pupil funding stream that can help school districts comply with teacher salary minimums. The cost also includes Iowa Public Employees Retirement System and the Federal Insurance Contributions Act, the U.S. Federal Payroll Tax, Buckton said. The math works. It's predictable, Buckton said. Peterson said educators and school finance leaders across the state are still not quite sure how funding salary increases would work in practice. We love the idea of making ourselves more competitive, so we stop losing education professionals who graduate from the University of Northern Iowa and go to work in Minnesota, Peterson said. We wish the governor would have had more education experts in the conversation to figure out if there wasn't a clearer way to do this. Solon School Superintendent Davis Idol said the district's first-year teachers currently make $40,000. About 32% of the teaching staff makes less than $50,000, he said. Idle said the district would need a tremendous amount of state support financially to meet the minimum teacher pay requirements if the bill were to pass. He estimates it would cost an additional $225,000 this year. Since 2020, the Solon School District has increased teacher salaries by almost 17%, he said. We do our best to stay competitive and help employees with inflation and the cost of living. Idle said Solon can't compete with the salaries neighboring school districts in Cedar Rapids and Iowa City offer teachers. They attract employees to Solon with small class sizes, infrastructure, and professional development opportunities, he said. If the state were to increase teacher salaries, Idle said he would like to extend teacher contracts as well to include more days for professional learning. We value every minute we get with our teachers. We would never want our family doctor to graduate from medical school and 20 years later never advance. I look at education the same way. Every year, we're applying new research. An extra 10 to 15 days with teachers would be really helpful, Idle said. Teaching is not a 9-to-5 job. Evenings are spent with lesson plans. There's always the need to continue your own education to learn and grow. There's a lot of demands to being an educator. On top of that, you're constantly struggling with finances, he said. Turning now to the Iowa Today page, Marion traffic cameras issue more than 6,500 citations. This story is by Emily Anderson. The city of Marion has collected $136,480 in traffic camera citations since the cameras were installed at two intersections last summer, but more than half of the 6,500 citations remain unpaid. The cameras started issuing citations for speeding and red light violations September 18 after a month of issuing warnings. The stationary cameras are at two intersections, Highway 100 and East Post Road, and Highway 13 and Highway 151. One mobile camera, which records only speeding violations, is placed based on citizen complaints. Between September 18 and December 31, cameras identified 12,588 speeding and red light violations and issued 6,543 citations, Marion Police Chief Mike Kitzmiller said in a Tuesday update to the Marion City Council. The violations that didn't receive a citation usually result when a license plate is not fully readable, or the license plate is registered to a different car than the one it is on, Kitzmiller told the council. Most of the citations, 4,072, were red light citations, with the remainder, 2,471, for speeding. Kitzmiller said many of the red light violations were for drivers who turned right on a red light without first stopping. There was a learning curve for people, he said. A lot of people forgot from driver's ed that you actually have to stop before you can turn right. Also, about a third of the violations, 2,178, went to Marion residents. The rest went to drivers living outside the city, with some going to out-of-state drivers. The highway's 13-151 cameras issued 3,023 red light citations and 62 speeding citations. The Highway 100 East Post Road cameras issued 1,049 red light citations and 267 speeding citations. The fastest speed clocked at either intersection was 86 miles an hour in the 55 mile an hour zone. About 4% of the citations, 279, have been contested. The registered owner of the car cited was found to be not liable in 28 of those cases, some where the car was stolen, some where plates were left on a car that had been sold, Kitzmiller said. We've had a couple instances where people have dropped their car off at mechanics shops, and we pick a car up speeding or running a red light when the mechanic is out doing a test drive after they do the repairs, Kitzmiller said. So for all the mechanic shops have ponied the money up to cover the citation. Since September 18th, 2,397 citations have been paid, resulting in $220,375 in fines, with $83,895 of that total going to Census Gatso. That's the company that installs and maintains the camera. Red light violations carry a fine of $100. Fines for speeding violations start at $75 for 11 miles an hour over the limit and then vary upward depending on speed. Fines that have not been paid are sent to a collections agency. Kitzmiller said many of the fines go unpaid at first because of an incorrect address. So far, 510 people have received two or more citations from the cameras, with one person racking up 12, Kitzmiller said. If someone is a repeat offender with multiple unpaid fines, they can receive a municipal infraction from the city. Kitzmiller told the council he may request to add more cameras in the future. He said the police department is planning to use the mobile speed camera to gather data on areas that may benefit from a permanent camera. One of the things that we see with the mobile unit is we've got a couple places here in town that every time we put it out, we get 100 citations, Kitzmiller said. For example, the camera issued 396 speeding citations in the 3 days it was parked in the 2800 block of 10th Avenue, where the average speed was 38 miles per hour in a 25 mile per hour zone. Kitzmiller said the cameras have saved a lot of time for officers. He said it takes 10 minutes for an officer to issue a ticket, so it would take about 400 hours of staff time to issue 2,397 tickets, the number of citations paid in the camera's first few months. Overall, I'm satisfied so far with what we've seen, Kitzmiller told the council. I want to get some more data so I can come back and show you the impact that these cameras are having, good or bad. Also in Iowa news, this story by Marissa Payne, Cedar Rapids seeking proposals for Ambrose Building for the fourth time. The fourth time may be the charm to redevelop the building that once housed the Ambrose Recreation Center. After three failed attempts to sell and repurpose the old brick building at 2000 Mount Vernon Road Southeast, the City of Cedar Rapids will take redevelopment proposals once more after receiving an inquiry from a developer. The approximately 18,700 square foot building has been closed since 2016, when the City Parks and Recreation Department moved to the new Northwest Recreation Center, 1340 11th Street Northwest. Most of Ambrose was built in 1903 to house Buchanan Elementary, with an addition made in 1962. The city acquired the building in 1975. I just think old is old, and this is one of those places where we happen to land right now, City Council member Ann Poe said. It's not like we haven't tried, so I'm all about this. In 2017, the one proposal the city received was later withdrawn. In April of 2019, the city sought proposals again and received two. The city council selected one, to turn the building into senior housing and authorized negotiation of a development agreement. The proposal was withdrawn because of the COVID-19 pandemic, Assistant Community Development Director Adam Lindenlaub told the council's development committee. Last year, Linn County received nearly $38 million in community development block grant disaster recovery funds funneled through the state toward recovery of 2020 derecho-damaged housing stock. That prompted another redevelopment attempt. With those funds on their way, city officials in August of 2022 issued a third request for proposals. They hoped prospective developers could tap into that funding source to help redevelop the 1.5-acre Ambrose site with the same objectives as before: advance a financially viable redevelopment based on current market conditions, encourage investment along the Mount Vernon Road corridor, and keep a unique sense of place through renovation or new construction. Councilmember Ashley Van Orney said the previous attempts show it's not as simple as just handing a building over to the city to repurpose. When you're not investing in these properties, they become dilapidated eyesores, Van Orney said. This was once a really lovely building that needs some love, needs some TLC to get back to its former days. I really hope that we can find some creative ways to finally get this project and give that neighborhood a product back into their community that they can use instead of having it sit vacant. The council is slated to set a public hearing on the project for noon, February 13th at City Hall, 101 First Street Southeast. Proposals would be due March 15 and come to the council for consideration this spring. If any proposals arrive, staff would negotiate a development agreement this summer and bring it back to the council for approval. And the article includes a photo by Jim Flaziorek for the Gazette of the Ambrose Recreation Center as it was seen in May of 2014. Turning now to the Insight page, the guest column is titled, Good Government Needs Informed Citizens. As Iowa's taxpayer watchdog, I hear from Iowans just about every day with concerns about state and local government. Oftentimes there are steps my office can take to address those concerns. Other times the next step is as simple as directing folks to the best channel in state government to address their question. Sometimes it's easy to also confuse misplaced priorities for misspent money. One requires a change in leadership, and the other requires an audit investigation. Randy Evans, the executive director of the Iowa Freedom of Information Council, wrote a column that raised questions about the responsibility of the state auditor to investigate secret government settlements. Mr. Evans writes that the situation, quote, should have state auditor Rob Sand knocking on the doors at City Hall and asking questions on behalf of the taxpaying people of Davenport, end quote. What many people don't know, however, is that the state auditor needs some form of a request to conduct a review at the local level. Most cities and school districts hire a private CPA firm to perform their annual required audit. For those places, the state auditor can't perform an additional engagement without a written request from an elected official or employee of the entity, or petition from at least 100 eligible electors of the entity. I've said many times that being a taxpayer watchdog isn't just a job for the state auditor. It's a job for the public, too. The people who know their community best are usually the ones who first notice when something is wrong. That's why we need local elected officials, public servants, and citizens like you to speak up. Good government only works when citizens are informed and involved in its outcomes. The state auditor's job is to be a bit of a nitpicker, and I can assure you nobody cheers when the auditor comes knocking. When public officials violate the public trust, though, they must be held accountable. But if it is something local, keep in mind, we need a qualifying request. That's the job I was elected to do. I'll always come down on the side of Iowa's taxpayers. Iowans always know that their taxpayer watchdog barks as often as necessary, whether the perpetrators are Democrats, Republicans, or independents. While that may keep some corrupt public officials up at night, the rest of us sleep soundly. If you have questions about how an audit works or have reason to suspect public dollars are being misused, please send us an email at info@aos.iowa.gov. And that's submitted today by Rob Sand, who is Iowa's state auditor. 24-hour Doorman today is titled, Trump Takes No Drama Caucuses. In the aftermath of Donald Trump's victory in the Iowa caucuses, some folks, not enamored with the notion of putting a clear and present danger to democracy back in the White House, took some comfort in the numbers. But like the weather in Iowa, it was cold comfort. Just roughly 110,000 voters participated, or 15% of more than 750,000 registered Republicans. So Trump's 30-point victory with 55,000 preference votes represents a very small slice of the Iowa Republican pie, and nearly half of the voters who showed up cast ballots for Trump's opponents. Don't call it a landslide, they insisted. Maybe it was a below-zero temperatures. Maybe it was the inevitability of a big Trump win. But Iowa has been a solidly Trumpian enclave for years. The Republican Party in Iowa has largely converted to Trumpism as Iowa transformed from a competitive purple state into a thoroughly red state led by Trump acolytes. The notion higher turnout would have produced a different outcome denies the facts. And Iowans who did show up had a choice between Trump and more reasonable Republican candidates. They still gave the former president a record-setting victory margin. Despite all the horrors of the Trump presidency and its aftermath, most Iowa Republicans want to make him president again. According to entrance polling, 66% of GOP caucus-goers believe President Joe Biden's 2020 win was illegitimate. Two-thirds believe Trump is fit for the presidency, even if he is convicted of crimes. My message of being a principled Republican with experience and telling the truth about the current frontrunner did not sell in Iowa, said former Arkansas Governor Asa Hutchinson. As he departed the presidential race on Tuesday, he received less than 200 votes. Not even Governor Kim Reynolds could convince her fellow Republicans to jump off the Trump train. Her endorsed candidate, Ron DeSantis, got second, but trailed Trump by 30 points. Trump and his campaign lambasted her for picking Ron DeSanctimonious. So, what now, Governor? I'll support Trump if he's the nominee, Reynolds told Neil Cavuto on Fox News. After all the stuff he said about you? Cavuto said. Yeah, because we've got to win, Reynolds said. After ignoring all the lies, impeachments, indictments, and a violent attempt to overturn a lawful election, it is pretty easy to blow off some name-calling. So there was little drama expected and even less delivered. Roughly a half hour after caucuses began, the Associated Press dubbed Trump the victor. Some caucus-goers hadn't even voted yet. The DeSantis campaign called it election interference. The Republican Party of Iowa called it highly disappointing and concerning. The AP can report what it knows any way it wants, but it was odd to rush to report a result everyone knew was coming, hardly a scoop. In the end, the result we assumed would happen for months, if not years, happened. NPR did the math and found that GOP hopefuls would spend $124 million on campaign ads, could have, instead, written a check to pay every caucus-goer $1,124. Maybe Iowans could have used the bucks to find real comfort in some place warm. And that is 24-hour doorman. We have one community letter today, and the title is Expand the Number of Community Health Workers. There is a critical issue impacting Iowa communities, the need for more community health workers. Community health workers are crucial to addressing ongoing rural health challenges, playing a vital role in linking healthcare providers with the communities. These workers manage and improve prevalent health conditions in Iowa, including asthma, high blood pressure, diabetes, mental health, and chronic disease. Studies in Texas, South Dakota, and Alabama have shown community health workers' effectiveness, particularly in rural areas. Consider 39% of Iowa's population resides in non-metro areas with limited health care services. Out of Iowa's 99 counties, 89 have been designated as health professional shortage areas for mental health and 52 for primary care, leading to an increase in mortality rates in rural communities. Despite a $2.47 return on every dollar invested, there is a lack of governmental support for community health care programs in Iowa. While Congress allocated resources to community health workers in response to the pandemic, Iowa lags neighboring states in expanding coverage. An upcoming bill aims to improve reimbursement for community health workers. under Medicare and Medicaid. It recognizes their role in enhancing healthcare quality, accessibility, and culturally responsive care while being cost-effective. This initiative can save Medicaid thousands of dollars per patient annually. To contribute to better health outcomes for Iowans, we urge U.S. Representatives Miller Meeks and Hinson and Senators Grassley and Ernst to support the Community Health Workers Bill. That letter is signed by Grace Fromelt, and Eli Steenhoek, partners in Health Engage Iowa City. You're listening to the reading of the Cedar Rapids Gazette for today, Thursday, January 18, on IRIS, the Iowa Radio Reading and Information Service for the Blind. And now we're turning to the obituary page, beginning with the short notices. First in Cedar Rapids, Evelyn L. Bechichka, age 95, died Tuesday, January 16, Brosh Chapel in the Ava Center. In Cedar Rapids, Leonard Scott Emerson III, age 60, died Tuesday, January 16, Cedar Memorial Park Funeral Home. In Cedar Rapids, Irene Frasher, age 81, died Tuesday, January 16, Murdoch Linwood Funeral Home and Cremation Service, Cedar Rapids. In Cedar Rapids, George Taylor Henry, 101, died Sunday, January 14, Cedar Memorial Park Funeral Home. In Cedar Rapids, Katie J. Hobbs, age 43, died Monday, January 15, Fry Funeral Home of Tipton. In Maquoketa, Nancy I., age 80, died Monday, January 15, Carson Celebration of Life Center. From Tama, Anna Rose Blair, 100, died Saturday, January 13th, Cruz Phillips Funeral Home. And in West Union, William, known as Bill Langreck, 77, died Monday, January 15. Helms Funeral Home in Decorah is assisting. Turning now to the regular notices, beginning in Cedar Rapids, Butch, Richard Reynolds, age 80, died Sunday, January 14. Service details will be shared at a later date. Butch was born June 3, 1943, to Lorna and Roy Reynolds. He lived on a farm and enjoyed growing up beside his dad, Roy, who shared his love of trucking. Dad started driving around age 16 and did it all his life. We are lost without you, but happy you're back with Ma and Brian. As you always told us, now we will tell you. Hammer down, driver. From Iowa City, Carolyn, known as Carney Burke, age 78, passed away January 15 after a courageous battle with colon cancer. A celebration of life is being planned. A family burial will be held at Memory Gardens. Carolyn was born October 30, 1945, in Ripley, West Virginia, the daughter of Walter and Ruth Kempf. She moved to Joetown, Iowa, in the spring of 1946, and then to Iowa City in 1950, where she would graduate from City High in 1963. Memorials are suggested to the American Cancer Society. From Shellsburg, Eleanor May Greider, age 87, passed away January 16th at St. Luke's Hospital in Cedar Rapids. Memorial service is at 2 p.m. Friday, January 19th at Rabbit Newhouse Funeral Service, the celebration of life to follow at the funeral home. Memorials may be directed to the family and online condolences sent at newhousefuneralservice.com. From Marion, Sandra L. Brenneman, age 88, passed peacefully on January 13th after an extended illness. Visitation will be held from 10 to 11 a.m. Monday, January 22nd at Murdoch Funeral Home and Cremation Service in Marion, with a brief memorial service to follow. Burial will follow at noon at Oak Shade Cemetery in Marion. Sandra was born April 1, 1935 in Manchester to Robert and Alta Matthews. She shared her childhood with her siblings, Sharon and Richard. memorial donations are suggested to in Sandra's memory to the Salvation Army or to the Alzheimer's Association. Please share a memory at murdochfuneralhome.com. From Marion, Keith Bright, age 97, passed away January 14. Keith was born May 31, 1926, to Charles Bright and Loretta Gilroy Bright. He grew up in the University Heights, graduated from St. Mary's High School, and attended the University of Iowa prior to joining the U.S. Navy in World War II. He was a member of St. Joseph Catholic Church and the American Legion Post 298. Please share a memory of Keith at cedarmemorial.com. In Cedar Rapids, Brian Swenson. It is with great sadness that we announce the passing of Brian Allen Swenson, who passed away early Saturday morning, January 13th, after a short illness at the age of 66. Brian was born in Mason City, Iowa, on October 7, 1957, to parents Tom Allen and Joanne Swenson. After graduating from Mason City High School, he studied and obtained a bachelor's degree at Northern Iowa University in Cedar Falls. Funeral services will be held Friday, January 19th at Prince of Peace Catholic Church, 14818 West Deer Valley Drive in Sun City West, Arizona, with the viewing at 10 a.m. and Mass scheduled at 11. Burial will take place at 1 p.m. at Holy Redeemer Cemetery, that's in Cave Creek, on Cave Creek Road in Phoenix, Arizona. Please send condolences to Prince of Peace in Sun City West. From Hiawatha, Emmett J. Prophet, age 75, passed away January 13th. Emmett will be buried at Cedar Memorial Park Cemetery in the Garden of Last Supper. Emmett was born October 29, 1948, in Cedar Rapids and worked several years for Collins Radio until his retirement. Condolences can be left at cedarmemorial.com. In Elkader, John Ian Deneau, and of Elkader, formerly of Cedar Rapids, passed away Thursday, December 21st. John was born in Decatur, Illinois, to Herman and Pauline Deneau on April 15, 1939. He was the firstborn of three. Growing up in various cities, he graduated in 1957 from Roosevelt High School in Cedar Rapids. He then attended and graduated from the Iowa Teachers College in Cedar Falls. Cards and condolences may be sent to 30675 Highway 13 in Elkader, Iowa, 52043. In memory of John, we recommend contributing to the Motor Mill Foundation, or consider getting involved in your local barbershop chorus. Morris Funeral Home in Guttenberg is assisting the family. Information is available at morrisfuneralhomes.com. From Newhall, Robert, known as Bob Paulson, age 96, passed away Friday, January 12, at the Vinton Lutheran Home. Visitation will be from 9 a.m. to 10 a.m. Tuesday, January 23 at St. John Lutheran in Newhall. A funeral service will follow at 10:30 a.m. Tuesday, January 23, with the Reverend Nick Palmer officiating. Burial at St. John Lutheran Cemetery west of Newhall with graveside military rites. Bob was born July 13, 1927 on the Paulson Family Farm north of Newhall, the son of John and Clara Paulson. He attended school through the eighth grade. The family would like to thank the staff at Vinton Lutheran Home for their loving care extended to Bob. Memorials are suggested to St. John Lutheran Church. From Olin, Thomas W. Hamilton, age 88, passed away peacefully Monday, January 15th at Harmony in Cedar Rapids. A visitation will be held from 4 to 7 p.m. on Thursday, January 18th at Dawson Funeral Services in Olin. His funeral service will be at 11 a.m. Friday, January 19th at Dawson Funeral Services. Burial will be at Stanwood Cemetery in Stanwood. Thomas Wayne was born July 24, 1935 to Theodore and Dorothy Buck Hamilton. He graduated from Wyoming High School in 1953 and served in the United States Army. Online condolences can be left for the family at DawsonFuneral.com. Cards of condolences can be directed to Dawson Funeral Services, P.O. Box 258 in Wyoming, Iowa, 52362, attention Thomas Hamilton family. From Cedar Rapids, Ruby Ray Keegan, age 85, passed away Tuesday, January 16. A memorial service will be held at 1 p.m. on Saturday, January 20th at Cedar Memorial Park Funeral Home. Visitation begins at 12:30 p.m. in the funeral home. Entrusted with the arrangements is Cedar Memorial Park Funeral Home, and you can leave a condolence at cedarmemorial.com. From Clarence, Mary Ann Wells, age 93, passed away Tuesday, January 16th at Unity Point St. Luke's Hospital in Cedar Rapids. Funeral services will be held on Saturday, January 20 at 2:30 at Chapman Funeral Home in Clarence, with Terry Hoy officiating. Visitation will be from 1:30 until service time. Burial will be in the Green Center Cemetery, rural Morley. Mary was born May 22, 1930, in Olin, to George and Vera Wilkins Smith. After attending Olin School, she worked at the shirt factory in Anamosa. She will be greatly missed by all who love her. Memories can be left at chapmanfh.com. And our final obituary today from Anamosa, Jean Hartwig, age 98, died Friday evening at her home following an extended illness. Betty Jean Mitchell, born July 10, 1925, to Alvin and Nina Maud Rathbun Mitchell, the youngest of three children. She graduated from Martell High School with the class of 1944, and after high school she went to business school in Cedar Rapids. She then went to work at Bankers Life as an assistant cashier. Private family services will be held on Monday, January 22nd at the Getch Funeral Home in Anamosa, with interment in the Antioch Cemetery, Anamosa. Pastor Carla Berg will officiate at the services. Thoughts, memories, and condolences are welcome at GetchOnline.com. Turning now to the sports page, one sideline note in the honors category, Jefferson High School will induct 9 new members into its Athletic Hall of Fame during ceremonies January 26th at the school. The new inductees are Heidi Butts, 1990, basketball, volleyball, track, and softball; Bob Driscoll, 1984, football, basketball, and track; Jim Doolin, 1973, football, basketball, and track; Liz Irby, 1998, softball; John Hegarty, Jr., 1975, football and wrestling coach; Guy Stoker, 1974, football, basketball, and baseball; Lauren Stolte, 2005, softball; Ed Threet, 1990, football and track; and Blake Tedke, 2001, football, basketball, and track. And this story by K.J. Pilcher in Boys Wrestling, Program Culture, Voss's Secret Sauce. Joe Voss admitted he has never concentrated on numbers. Oh, he knew a milestone was coming when he had to fill out preseason surveys and questionnaires to promote his wrestlers and the program. He quickly forgot about it as soon as he started mopping the West Delaware wrestling room the Sunday before the official first day of practice. The Hawks, his family, friends, and program supporters knew the significance of last Thursday's 31-28 victory at Class 2A number 14, Solon. Voss became just the 8th coach in Iowa history to reach 500 career dual wins. Number 4, West Delaware, improved to 12-2 and boosted his all-time mark to 536-1, entering Thursday's duel at rival Independence. "I knew it was going to happen at some point this year," Voss said. "I just didn't know when. We're just trying to get our team to wrestle as good as we can and get the kids healthy. That's been our focus. A banner made by his son, Jared, a former West Delaware prep, and the 184-pound starter for Coe College was on display, depicting some memories during the past 28 seasons as Hawks head coach. There have been a lot of them, highlights, over the years, where maybe we weren't the favored team, but the kids battled for each other and our program, Voss said. When kids could do that for the name on their singlet, those are special. Voss was an assistant for 4 seasons, leaving to serve as Monticello head coach for 1 year before returning to lead West Delaware since the 1995-96 season. He has guided West Delaware to 7 overall state championships in 29 seasons. The Hawks won a traditional tournament title in 2013 and state duels crowns in 2020 and 2022. They swept both championships in 2019 and 2021. Former West Delaware state champion and current assistant Mitch Payton said Voss has thrived thanks to a constant desire to get better and evolve. What he teaches now is way different than back in the 1990s when he coached me, said Payton, whose sons Logan and Jaden were on state duels championship teams. He always wants to put the wrestlers in the best position to have success. He has also cared about each kid in the room and not just the studs. It takes 14 guys pulling for each other to have success as a team, and he has constantly had 30-plus wrestlers in the room each year. The culture he has built doing all of this has been the secret sauce, in my opinion. 11 Hawks have combined to win 13 individual state titles under Voss, Adam Reth, and current Northern Iowa 197-pounder Wyatt Volker, who was 5th at the 2023 Greco-Roman Championships, were 2 state champions. He's successful because he cares for the whole community and wants the best guy on the team to get better as much as he wants the little manager to get better, Volker said. He doesn't care about his win-loss record. He cared about improving yourself as a human being and making a strong family culture. He does it in a unique way as well, allowing the wrestlers to make the culture and doesn't force rules. There's a kind of standard, and everyone upholds it, from the manager to the best guy in the room. Voss has been blessed with consistency. Scott Litterer, a state championship head coach as well, and Chris Lenz have been longtime assistants. Much of his staff is comprised of former wrestlers, Peyton, Reth, Brent Lammers, Nathan Voski, Brian Klaus, and his older son, Jake. The key is who you surround yourself with, Voss said. I've been extremely fortunate to surround myself with a lot of great people. When you do that and everybody's on the same page for helping kids get better and achieve their goals, things like this happen. I think it's a lot of people around me who have played a big role in it. Another major contribution has come from home. Each member of the Voss family has had a part. Jake and Jared were state medalists who helped the Hawks to a number of victories. His daughters Joanna and Jenny were team managers, administrative assistants, as Voss classified them. His wife Jeanette is a team photographer and has organized a lot behind the scenes. This is a feat shared by them. We figured out pretty early that it's a pretty big commitment, Voss said. They all went together with it. It makes it special. The fact that they wanted to be involved makes it pretty cool. We got to spend a lot of time with each other, share a lot of memories, and the support they've given over the years has been out of this world. It makes it pretty cool when the family was along for the journeys. And the article is accompanied by several photos from the Gazette with West Delaware head coach Jeff Voss as he reacts to different wrestling meets. Also in this high school sports story, which I'll abbreviate in the interest of time, Saints Nolte aiming to grow the sport. And this is girls bowling. The article is by Ryan Plegenkuhl. Miranda Nolte has a clear legacy in mind when her time as a high school bowler comes to an end. It's not about the impact of her individual accomplishment, per se. It's about changing how the bowling program is perceived at Cedar Rapids Xavier. I think a lot of people just don't see it, bowling, as much of a sport, but it's also recreational, Nolte said. I just want girls bowling to become more popular at Xavier. Nolte, a senior and 2023 state qualifier, hopes future generations of Saints can share the same enjoyment of the program that she's had. I want more people to get involved, Nolte said. I think we're having scores that are getting noticed, or just talking about how much fun it can be, then people will start to notice, and maybe they'll give it a try. Xavier ranks 9th in Class 2A in score per game and has 2 top 20 scorers. Turning now to the Things to Do column in the family-friendly area, this year's first Pajama Story Time will feature a local artist and her abstract artwork in the exhibition Power and Impact, a survey of 21st century Black visual artists in Iowa. Akwi Nagy will read the story What Do You See? And help everyone with their artwork. That takes place at the Cedar Rapids Museum of Art today from 7 to 8 p.m. and it's free. At the Hiawatha Public Library, come share your love of comics and graphic novels with like-minded readers. That takes place from 7 to 8 p.m. and that also is free. Today's feature in the Hoopla section is titled A Big Dill. Pickle Palace brings 3 floors of dining and recreation to Cedar Rapids. This article by Elijah Desius, which I'll abbreviate. With multiple concepts, over 37,000 square feet for dining, drinking, recreation, and relaxation, Cedar Rapids' newest opening is a pretty big deal. Pickle Palace, the second opening in the city's $81.5 million mixed-use development dubbed Kingston Yard, makes an understatement of the latter word with something for everyone. Its 3 floors encompass a casual sit-down restaurant, a bar, indoor and outdoor pickleball courts with a towering 30-foot ceiling, a British-themed bar, near wraparound rooftop patio, duck pin bowling, and private event space. In brief, if you go, it's called the Pickle Palace at 101 First Avenue Southwest in Cedar Rapids. Hours vary between the restaurant, the pickleball courts, and the third floor. You can visit their website for more details. That website is playpicklepalace.com. Restaurant entrees average about $15. You can phone them by calling 319-582-4780. Finishing up with just a brief bit about the weather, snow likely late today, winds out of the north at 10 to 20 miles an hour, Cedar Rapids looking for a high of 15 today, 4 tomorrow, and 1 on Saturday. The normal high today is 27, the normal low is 11. A record high of 56 degrees was set in 1996, and a record low of 24 degrees below zero was set in 1930. We have 9 hours and 33 minutes of daylight today, and we're in the first quarter of the moon phase, with moonrise at 11:33 a.m. That does it for the reading of the Cedar Rapids Gazette for today, Thursday, January 18. I've been your reader, Kathleen. You can access a recording of today's reading anytime on iowaradioreading.org. Thanks for listening, and have a great, safe day. Stay warm.
From the Bureau of Economic Geology, this is Earth Date.
Since the dawn of humankind, people have used caves to explore, hold religious ceremonies, create art, or avoid the dangers of weather and predators. Partly because of that, they continue to fascinate scientists today. To create a cave, Mother Nature needs three things: water, rock that can be dissolved by it, and lots of time. Rainwater, as it falls through the atmosphere, picks up carbon from CO2 to become a weak carbonic acid. By the time it hits Earth, it's about as acidic as coffee. As it percolates through the soil, it picks up more carbon from decaying plants, becoming a slightly stronger acid. If the rock below the soil is limestone, gypsum, or dolomite, the water can dissolve along tiny cracks. Over many thousands of years, the cracks become channels, then tunnels, and could eventually become caverns. Water might also mix with hydrogen sulfide gas seeping up from natural oil and gas deposits to form sulfuric acid, which can also dissolve the rock. Protected from daily and seasonal changes on the surface, caves can maintain a stable temperature and humidity. In these delicate environments, the remains of ancient animals and humans, which could have quickly decayed on the surface, have been preserved for millennia. Deeper, more isolated caves have preserved bacteria and microbes undisturbed for millions of years. These qualities make caves important sites for researchers, natural time capsules. There's probably an amazing cave near you, so take a trip and get to know your Earth. I'm Scott Tinker, dissolving mysteries on Earth Date.
Earth Date is produced by the Bureau of Economic Geology at the University of Texas at Austin, with support from Schlumberger, helping oil and gas companies increase production and efficiency while lowering environmental impact. You can hear more Earth Date stories at earthdate.org.